Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with our second episode about the story of Kirk Allen, or at least based on the story of Kirk Allen.
Yeah, the story of Kirk Allen being a recurring element, but ultimately we're talking about, imagination. We're talking about daydreams. We're talking about how we try to objectively understand the universe, even as more subjective narratives are presented to us, narratives like UFOs or demons, etc.
Or traveling into the future and being a space lord.
Exactly.
Now, if you haven't heard the last episode, you should probably go and check that one out first, where we tell the whole story of Kirk Allen. We're going to be following up on some of the threads from it in this one and pursuing some research on the idea of maladaptive daydreaming.
Yeah, because the idea with Kirk Allen is that essentially, the short version is you had a guy with a very important job, like a nuclear physicist for a government institution, that was daydreaming so much that it became a problem, that his employer said, we want you to go talk to a professional about this.
Now, the story goes, at least as it's presented by his therapist, who is writing later and fictionalizing elements of the story, both to protect the identity of the patient and, as far as we know, maybe not also embellishing the story to make it a better story. We don't know. But the story goes that Kirk Allen, the pseudonym for this patient, that he was referred to Robert Lindener, the therapist, and that Lindener became so involved in Kirk Allen's beliefs that he could travel into the future and in his mind and be a space lord and go from planet to planet and explore all these technologies and galactic civilizations, that he got so involved in that he started to believe it himself. And then it took Kirk Allen admitting that he made the whole thing up and didn't actually believe any of it to snap the therapist out of believing in the delusion.
And it makes for a great story. Like, it illustrates like the power, the contagious nature of a compelling fiction.
Exactly. But today we wanted to explore this other element of it. So if we go with the story and we assume that Kirk Allen never did believe any of what he was saying, he never actually believed he was a space lord. He just spent a lot of time fantasizing about it, though mm-hmm. he could tell the difference between his fantasy and reality. What would that situation be? Imagine you've got this guy, he's doing important nuclear physics or whatever other kind of government research, and they can't keep him on task because he's always thinking about how he's going to finish his paper on the hyperdrive thruster that'll get him to Tau Ceti 9 or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the cool thing about all this, and I think ultimately the fascinating part about it, is that I think we can all relate on some level to the you know, the attractive power of daydreaming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all do it, and certainly we all did it when we were children. I mean, I've always had a pretty active imagination. As a kid, I was content to pace around the backyard. I would generally have a red or a green rubber band in my hand, and I would just daydream a litany of imagined worlds inspired, you know, by typical things that are going to inspire a kid, you know, the TV shows, movies, cartoons, and action figures, that sort of thing. And I think everybody in my family probably thought I was a little bit weird because of it, but they, you know, they tolerated it, if only so they could continue to make fun of me as an adult. And, you know, and to everyone's credit, they encouraged my creative activities later on in life that employed much of the same energy, just without the rubber band and all the pacing. So I guess maybe I still do some of the pacing, but
Robert, you do the pacing. Have you not noticed?
Yeah. It's good for one to get up all the time during work.
Not trying to call you out. I pace too.
One thing I do now is I do a lot of swimming, and while I'm swimming, I am inevitably doing some form of imaginative thought, some sort of daydreaming. I'm thinking about, say, the fiction podcast that I'm putting together here for How Stuff Works, and sort of plotting that out. It's all sort of an experiment in like constructive daydreaming, right? If I'm lucky enough to visit a beach, that's the kind of thing that occupies my mind on long walks. Like I love those times in my life when I'm able to not worry about the future or hang up over the past and instead just daydream about something completely different.
Well, as I've said recently on the show, I think narrative is a sacred retreat, but it's not just a sacred retreat when you're reading the narratives of others. It's certainly a sacred retreat when you're composing your own.
Yeah. Now, I have to say that I'm fortunate to have outlets for my creativity, and I'm also very fortunate that daydreaming and imagination doesn't negatively impact my life, at least currently. And not everyone, though, can make these claims.
Yeah, that's a lot of what we're going to be focusing on today is like when it crosses that line, when daydreaming goes over the line and becomes something not so positive but more destructive to people's lives. You know, thinking about my own childhood, I can specifically remember the process of trying to prolong or re-enter dreams that I had exited by waking up.
Mm.
Did you ever have this experience?
Yes, I remember doing that.
I remember in particular this one dream I had where I found a tunnel in my closet, and crawling through the tunnel, it went to a beach where there was a girl there who was a friend of mine, and she could turn into a fish, I think, or a dolphin or a cat. But I could also, in this dream, swing around on tree branches by using a whip like Indiana Jones. And that was just the coolest thing ever because I loved Indiana Jones, and I especially loved the swinging action.
That sounds amazing. That reminds me of how I once had a Rocketeer dream.
Mm-hmm.
Only once did I have this dream where I was flying with the Rocketeer's jetpack, and it was just so beautiful. It was just so breathtaking, and I've never had that dream again.
Yeah. I remember this just being an overwhelmingly fun dream. I had a morphin friend, and I could swing around in tree branches like Indiana Jones. And for some reason, it was just so fun that when I woke up, I was like, oh, I've got to get back there.
Yeah.
And I tried to re-enter it. But I couldn't do it. I tried to go back to sleep again and dream the same dream, but I couldn't make myself. And I remember trying really hard to imagine having the same dream again while I was awake, but I couldn't really do that either, at least not with the same intensity. And I know this wasn't the only time I tried to recreate a dream state while I was awake. This is just one really vivid one that I remember. And I think this impulse to try so hard to imagine myself back into a dream sort of is part of what led me to become interested in fiction writing, because while dreams always fade very quickly in memory, even very vivid ones tend to if you don't talk about them or write them down after you wake up, imaginary scenarios coded down in writing, those are permanent and you can re-enter them with full fidelity at any time.
You know, your story reminds me a lot of H.P. Lovecraft's the Dream Quest of Unknown Caddith.
I don't know that one.
It's a wonderful and imaginative tale, very unlike most of his – it's one of his dream stories. So it's more fantasy than horror, though it has you know, horror elements for sure. But the basic idea is that a dreamer, a man, dreams a dream so beautiful that the gods, the elder beings, deny it to him. And he has to go on a quest to try and reclaim that dream.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Is it beautiful or sad and melancholy that that's so much of what life is not necessarily chasing a new experience that you haven't had, but trying to recapture a perfect experience you remember?
Yeah, it's true. It kind of gets to the heart of the power of nostalgia, right?
Yeah.
You know, in our previous episode, we talked a good deal about Carl Sagan's The Demon Haunted World.
Mm-hmm. Because that was the context in which we read this original story about Kirk Allen.
Yeah, and Sagan has a wonderful quote here just about fantasy and reality that I wanted to read. He says, quote, "Out of all these contending propensities and child-rearing practices, some people emerge with an intact ability to fantasize and a history extending well into adulthood of confabulation. Others grow up believing that everyone who doesn't know the difference between reality and fantasy is crazy. Most of us are somewhere in between."
That's a good point. I mean, so obviously somebody who is too wrapped up in their fantasies in their own head, that person is obviously going to be having trouble. Mm-hmm. And when you encounter somebody like that, you can often recognize it. But I think equally, you don't trust somebody at the far opposite end of the spectrum who just has no tolerance for imagination. You know, you sometimes meet people like this.
Oh yeah, I saw a guy at it was a tiki bar in Hawaii. And he was ordering a drink, probably a Mai Tai or something, but he had specific directions for the server. He said, "Bring me one of these, but no umbrellas, no fancy mug. Just make, you know, basically make this drink as boring as possible. No fun for me.
No umbrellas. Like, I refuse to pretend that there's a tiny man living on the surface of my drink that needs shade from the sun."
Exactly. It's like, why are you even here if you're not here to engage in funny umbrella drinks?
Oh, that's a tiki bar heretic right there.
But let's come back to just the subject of daydreaming and creativity.
Robert, you know who had some interesting thoughts about daydreaming and creativity?
Who?
Good old Sigmund Freud.
Oh, I bet he did.
Dr. Joy. So he talked about this in a 1907 essay called Creative Writers and Daydreaming. And I just want to preempt, please do not take this discussion as an endorsement in general of Freudianism. While Freud is, of course, a very important figure to read in the history of ideas, a lot of his influence on psychology has given way to much more, you know, rigorous, more explicitly science-based practices. I think these days Freud is more worth reading in the vein of thinking about him as a kind of like philosopher or something. But so Freud starts with one of those great questions that we might sometimes think of as too simple or too fundamental to actually ask out loud. Though, Robert, you might have heard this one before. You know, somebody knows you write fiction or they read one of your stories and they ask you, "Robert, where do you get your ideas? How do you think up what to get the characters to say and to do?" Have you ever been asked this?
Yeah, I've been asked versions of this before.
I've been asked this too. I was actually asked it fairly recently, and it's always struck me as a bizarre question because I thought – I don't know. I would think the answer is obvious. It's like I get ideas by using my imagination and imagining what the character would do. But the fact that some people end up asking this question of other people indicates that obviously not everybody has the same propensity for imagining fictional characters and places and scenarios and all that. So to some people, it comes more naturally than it does to others.
I mean, I'm always reminded of the subject of aphantasia, you know, the idea that not everyone can form mental images, which doesn't directly relate to what we're talking about here, but it's a reminder of just how different our brains can be. So I can, you know, see why someone might not initially grasp how an imagined character comes to speak or act. And they might find it harder still to understand how these fictional characters that people dream up may well think or act in ways that the imagineer does not expect.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, one of the things I notice in writing is that the process of creativity, at least for me, is very highly shaped by the act of recording the creative process. Mm-hmm. So it's like writing a story is very different than just trying to think out a story in my head. Once it turns into words, then you realize, oh, all this has got to change.
Yeah, I often feel like I have to processes that I'm working with. One is that daydreaming while I'm swimming laps or whatever. But then there's the process of actually writing things, and things may change drastically depending on the demands of that process.
Just to point out quickly also before we move on, you mentioned the idea that not everybody can form images in their head as one possible factor affecting whether people can compose fiction. But we've heard from people who are fiction writers who have aphantasia.
Oh, no. Yeah, I bring it up more as just an example of how our brains are different.
Oh, exactly.
Not that it would impact – it would change the way one composes fiction, I think.
Oh, sure.
But certainly someone with aphantasia can and they do write fiction. They do come up with fabulous ideas.
Yeah.
We often fall into that trap of thinking that everyone has a brain more or less like mine. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's more powerful than mine, or maybe it's not as finely tuned as mine. But all our brains are basically the same. And an example like aphantasia just reminds you, no, this is not the case at all.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So Freud began by observing this idea that not all brains are the same, and that not all brains are the same in terms of ability to be creative, to come up with creative stories. And specifically for the purpose of this conversation, we are talking about creativity in terms of like making up stories, not the more generalized idea of creativity.
Right, which can and does entail things that are not like, literature major creativity. I mean, certainly there is creativity within science. There's creativity within programming, et cetera.
There's creativity in getting a piece of meat out of a cage trap.
Exactly.
But no, so we're talking about like coming up with ideas, like creative storytelling and stuff. So Freud says, you know, even non-creative people do have some experience with the thinking of creative writers. Even if you're one of these people who asks, how do you come up with your ideas? How do you know what the characters should do? These people, Freud says, do have experience with that because it's in the imagination-based play of their childhood. Think back on your childhood. What was it like to play pretend? And he writes, quote, "Might we not say that every child at play behaves like a creative writer, in that he creates a world of his own, or rather rearranges the things of his world in a new way which pleases him? It would be wrong to think he does not take the world seriously. On the contrary, he takes his play very seriously, and he expends large amounts of emotion on it. The opposite of play is not what is serious, but what is real."
Might we not say that every creative writer is a giant baby? I'm kidding.
Well, I agree with that last part of what Freud says, because play is a departure from constraints, not a departure from stakes. There's nothing in the world more serious and important than what happens in a child's game. You know from experience.
Yeah, I mean, if the floor is lava, the floor is lava.
Yeah.
Though I have to say, play is definitely a topic that demands its own episode at some point. I mean, there's so much going on when a child plays, even when an adult engages in play. And then, of course, we have other mammals that engage in play as well, especially when they're young.
Totally true. So Freud says that the creative writer just extends this type of play into adulthood and then uses the help of writing to record the play. Otherwise, the process is very similar. The creative writer creates a world of fantasy and then takes it very seriously by investing huge amounts of genuine emotion into it, but keeps it separated sharply from the constraints of reality. So what's happening here? Why does the daydreamer or the fiction writer do this? You know, why does the play in the imagination happen? And Freud notes something. He says, what's common to almost every single work of fiction?
Well, we got to have a hero, right?
Exactly.
Like the song says, we need a hero.
Right. I'm holding out for a hero for Freudian reasons.
There you go.
Now, this obviously, there's all kinds of fiction out there in the world today. There's experimental fiction and fiction that breaks every rule in the book, right? Mm-hmm. But most fiction still does abide by this. You've got to have a hero around which the interest of the story is centered and to which the author wishes to engender the audience's sympathies. And another thing he points out is that the hero is, by necessity of the plot, invulnerable. The reader can always trust that the hero will not be killed in chapter two, or else there would be no story.
Or at least that's what it's like as an adult. I feel like anytime I get my son to watch, anytime we introduce him to a new film, mm-hmm. He does not realize that the main character is going to make it to the end of a children's film.
Man, I wish I could go back to that. That's amazing.
I know. It's at once amazing and frustrating because on one hand, it's like, wow, he is experiencing this film with such raw, vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, it's like, I just want you to be able to watch Moana and with the family. We just want to make it to the end of this movie. It's just a Disney princess movie. We should be able to handle it.
Don't you dare take that magic away from him. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Like, God, I can't believe it. I remember what that was like mm-hmm. back before I understood all of the like cliches of story structure when every narrative was a radical surprise to me.
Yeah.
Things aren't quite like that anymore. And I wish I could return to that mind state. But anyway, sorry, going back to Freud. So Freud notices that the hero is always invulnerable by necessity of the plot. And also the hero enjoys unrealistic good fortune in like love and romance. So Freud writes, quote, "Through this revealing characteristic of invulnerability, we can immediately recognize His Majesty the Ego, the hero alike of every daydream and every story."
It's probably telling about the kind of fiction I read, but I can't remember the last time I read something where the protagonist had great fortune in love and romance. I feel like they're mostly having a pretty bad time.
Well, I think if you take the long view,
okay.
Right, when the stories resolve, there are a lot of stories where people go through a lot of tragedy and then in the end, everything comes out right.
All right, I'll get back to you on that. I'm going to do a full cataloging of recent reads for that.
What's your Freudian analysis of the R. Scott Baker books?
Everybody has a pretty tough time with relationships, for starters.
It's something about death drive, maybe.
Maybe.
Anyway, so ultimately, Freud gets Freudian, right? He says that both the daydream and the act of creative writing, which are really sort of one and the same thing, realized through different means, he says these are the result of unconscious memories, which give rise to an unfulfilled wish, and the wish is then fulfilled through the daydream or the act of creative writing, but in a way that is tempered by the social and moral restraints imposed by society. This obviously is, classic Freudian kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to give any credence to this repressed childhood memory part, which is probably nonsense, to appreciate there may be some insight in the earlier parts about drawing this connection between the creative process and what's going on in daydreaming.
Oh, by the way, if anyone would want anyone wants like a deeper exploration of like early childhood trauma and Freudian ideas, there's an older episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind about the work of H.R. Giger and some Freudian explanations for his visual style.
Was Giger a Freudian?
I don't think he was quite a Freudian, but at least one major commentator on his work was, and pointed to a lot. Basically, the death and birth imagery, that weird biomechanical synthesis of things that are both vibrantly alive and just unredeemably dead.
Hmm. Interesting. I can actually see a redemptive arc of Freudianism, maybe not so much as as the best tool for psychology, but maybe as like a literary and artistic criticism school.
Well, like it comes back to what you said earlier about Freud being perhaps more useful today if you think of him as a philosopher.
And I do think there's something to his insight here, like drawing this connection between daydreaming and the creative impulse in order and appreciating that the story spinning impulse, whether it's in creative writing or simple daydreaming, is psychologically important. And it does in many cases fill some psychological need and provide some psychological benefit. But as we're exploring today, it can spill over into territory that's clearly not beneficial, such as in the case of Kirk Allen, like we were talking about earlier, where it was interfering with his work enough that his superiors got in touch with Lindner, or in many cases of what has come to be known as maladaptive daydreaming. And we will explore that more when we come back from a break.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Uses directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But We Loved is a new podcast about queer history coming May 15th. I'm Jordan Gonsalves, your host. Growing up, I thought being gay was the worst thing I could ever be. The gay history I learned was tragic.
Jerry had died of AIDS, and it's like, what is happening?
It was survival. That's why it's called survival sex.
But as I interviewed queer elders, I realized there was another history that I had never been taught. A history of courage and perseverance.
I wanted to take control of my story and not be ashamed of it.
And it was a history full of love.
The joy we found in saying husband again and again and again was incredible.
And while learning this new queer history from my elders, I realized they had so much wisdom to pass down.
The key is to understanding yourself, learning to love and embrace yourself.
From iHeart Podcasts, I'm Jordan Gonsalves, and this is But We Loved. Listen to But We Loved May 15th on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
All right, we're back. So maladaptive daydreaming. It seems pretty obvious, right? Daydreaming that is maladaptive. That is probably not having a good influence on your life. Things are out of balance because of your daydreaming.
Right. It's a term coined by the Israeli clinical psychologist Eli Sommer, and Sommer defines the term to mean, quote, extensive fantasy activity that replaces human interaction and or interferes with academic, interpersonal, or vocational functioning. So essentially, it is fantasizing that interferes with your life. And there's actually been kind of a renaissance of attention to this subject just in the past couple of years.
Yeah, there's a in particular there's an excellent episode of the NPR podcast Invisibilia. Have you listened to Invisibilia?
No, I haven't. Well, I listened to a little clip from this episode, but that's all.
Yeah, it's a wonderful series. And there's one episode in particular that discusses the story of a 49-year-old suburban mother who they refer to as M, whose rich inner world becomes a secret addiction that she keeps from her family. So so it's not just that she's escaping into her daydreams, you know, while she's driving to work or while she's swimming laps or what have you. No, she's making up excuses and cover stories to go off and dream in this world.
Right. So this is an adult living a mostly normal life, but she engages in elaborate fantasies about space adventures and saving the Earth and getting sucked into a black hole and all this. And she's got fictional companions who are her fictional friends. And she sometimes does this for multiple hours a day. And there's one part that I found very moving where she mentions – one thing about these fantasy worlds is that you know you're going to be understood in them because all the characters are you.
Oh, wow. On one hand, that's beautiful. But then I think of like characters that I've created, and I feel like most of them probably would not tolerate me. So I don't know if they really would understand me or not.
You need to create more sympathetic characters.
Probably so. Probably so.
So you can hear just from that, you know, that she can go to this place to be understood. So it obviously serves some purpose for her. You know, it helps her cope and it helps her feel better in a way. But it also, you know, she wonders if this is doing more harm than good in her life, right? Because if you have to spend all this time in secret doing this thing that you keep secret from your family, I mean, this is generally not healthy behavior and it's going to lead to a lot of negative effects. So what does it mean for daydreaming to become a problem, a real problem on the level of a disorder that people would want to seek professional help to cure? Robert, I don't know if you share this bias, but I feel like in reading about this subject, one of the things that's been really hard for me to get around is a bias I have to think about daydreaming as a just inherently very good and admirable thing.
Yeah, I agree, because I, for one, am a daydream believer. So I'm going to always side with the daydreamers.
I was just looking at a meme on the internet that has a unicorn on it and it says, don't quit your daydream. I mean, and that's supposed to be a whimsical but encouraging thing to say. Like, I associate daydreaming with the character trait of imagination, which most of us view as a good thing. I certainly do. And think about this. Robert, imagine you're picking up a new novel,
okay,
and there's a young character in the story who's introduced as always daydreaming through classes in school or something. Do you expect this character to turn out to be a hero or a villain?
I'd say they are either the hero or they are about to be tragically transformed into the villain, or
yeah,
they're just an introductory character that's going to be killed by a villainous force before we move on to the actual protagonist.
Well, no matter what, they're sympathetic at this point.
Oh,
right?
Yes, definitely.
Daydreaminess is an inherently sympathetic trait, but I think this is because we usually think about it in several contexts. Number one, it's primarily an activity of children and the young. Would you agree with that?
Yes. If nothing else, it is often seen as, yeah, sort of a childlike quality, right?
Yeah. Number two, I'd say it's usually done in a positive sense of aspiration and ambition. Like in fictional narratives, daydreaming about a different kind of life is often foreshadowing that character will actually later get to do those things that they daydreamed about. Number three, at least in fiction, it's usually grounded within an otherwise functional set of relationships and behavior patterns. It's not usually presented as something that keeps people from doing what's right or having relationships.
Right. Their daydreaming is their escape from their daily troubles.
Yeah, and that's the fourth part. The fourth part is that it's usually brought about by unfair external constraints, like a child is in an intellectually deadening grammar class, and it causes that child, let's say it's our young heroine, to sit there dreaming about, you know, shooting a bow off the back of a horse or about space adventures because she's in this horribly boring, mind-numbing scenario. I certainly feel all of this in general. And so this episode is certainly not to cast a negative light on all forms of daydreaming, because there are clearly lots of cases where daydreaming is great. But there are also plenty of cases we've come to understand where daydreaming goes beyond a harmless exercise of imagination and it becomes a destructive obsession, causing harm to the dreamer and to the people around them.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say if daydreaming prevents one from being present when one should be present or when one wishes to be present, then it could certainly be seen as a problem. You know, I think it's one of those, it could be viewed as one of those chains of iron, chains of gold situations, right? Like if you're not present with a loved one due to worries over past or future events, that's one thing. But isn't it still just as bad as if you're half zoning out during a conversation with a loved one because there's a space battle going on in your head? Mm-hmm. It's a fantasy, much in the same way that many of our worries are ultimately fantasies about things going wrong.
Yeah, that's a form of daydreaming as well.
Yeah, coupled with, say, fantasies about, say, winning the lottery or finding – this is one I still do all the time. I think it's from watching various, like, kidnapping movies. But I'll think, what if I happen upon a garbage can and there's like a drop-off of money in the garbage?
Yeah.
And then I get to take off with the money. And not, of course, I won't be killed by the hitmen or the kidnappers or what have you. But surely I'll get away with the money I just found in the trash can. But it's a stupid fantasy that's still like, you know, I don't dwell on it, but it still flies through my head every now and then, two or three times a week tops.
You find yourself checking garbage cans sometimes?
I mean, I don't actually dig in them, but I, you know, I don't go looking for the money. But for some reason,
kind of lean and peek. Yeah,
in a sense, like this, just this stupid fantasy will rear its head for just a moment without me even you know, really thinking about it.
One thing I find is that obviously media influences what kinds of things we daydream about. Mm-hmm. Did you notice a lot of people, including yourself, during, say, the late 2000s when zombie movies were everywhere, mm-hmm. constantly thinking about the best place to get to defend from a zombie attack?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that falls into sort of worst case disaster fantasizing.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I'd want to be on top of that building right mm-hmm. there. And here's what I'd want to have with me. And mercifully, the zombie craze has somewhat died down. I think people are thinking about that kind of thing less. I'm still wondering Freudian explanations to the side. Like, why do we do that? What's going on in our brains when we daydream? Like, so you're just hanging out, maybe waiting to meet a friend or something like that. And then you start thinking like, what would be the best building around here to defend from a zombie attack? What's going on in your brain then?
Well, this actually brings us back to something we've discussed in the show plenty of times before, the default mode network. I was looking at a 2017 University of Cambridge study that found that the brain network previously associated with daydreaming, the default mode network, also seemed to play a role, an important role in allowing us to perform tasks on autopilot.
Autopilot. So like when you are, say, that like highway hypnosis kind of thing?
Yeah, or I'm loading the dishwasher, you know, yeah. or taking clothes to taking the laundry to the washing machine, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Things you've done so many times that you just kind of zone out and you're thinking about space battles or the lottery or what have you. The researchers here were also very interested in this because abnormal activity in the default mode network has been linked to an array of disorders, including Alzheimer's disease, schizophrenia, attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, and disorders of consciousness. And this study in particular found that the default mode network plays an important role in allowing us to switch to autopilot once we are familiar with a task.
Hmm.
So it seems fitting that the default mode network should emerge again in an episode on daydreaming. We've discussed it quite a bit in the past as this is where we find so much of the worry and anxiety that we seek to escape through flow states, such as a creative activity like creative writing or wood carving or yoga or anything like this. As well as through meditation or, you know, some other kind of meditative activity. The default mode network activity is also linked to difficulty in sleeping in new environments. You know, it's just kind of
totally this, find this to be true.
Yeah. So you have just like this heightened narrative of things that have gone wrong and things that might go wrong. And I feel like myself, especially, so much of my life comes down to trying to turn the volume down on that network.
Yeah. You never get a good night's sleep the first time you're somewhere new.
Yeah. Furthermore, Daniel Kahneman proposed in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, that we use two systems to make decisions, a rational system for calculated decisions and a fast system for intuitive decisions. And this Cambridge study argued that it's the latter system, the fast system, that may be linked with the default mode network. So it sounds as if daydreaming is kind of a mistake of cognition, right? A byproduct of it at any rate. Our predictive software to envision not only extreme cases of joy or horror, but impossible fantasies, fantasies that may not even involve us, you know?
But that's – now that's considering standard daydreaming, which as we've discussed is extremely common. I mean, almost everybody does it. Just to cite a couple figures on that. For one thing, in the book Daydreaming in 1966, Singer reported that 96% of normal non-clinical adults who were educated and living in the United States daydreamed at least every day. And so that kind of thing happens most when the person is alone, right? You are, say, laying in bed at night, getting ready to go to sleep, and you start to daydream. You imagine, you know, scenarios. You imagine fantasies. Your mind wanders.
Oh, wow. Well, mine does it far more often than that.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, 96% of people at least do this once a day.
Oh, okay.
And there's some evidence that it happens even more often. There's a really good article in The Atlantic from 2015 that I'll come back to a few times in this episode called When Daydreaming Replaces Real Life by Jane Bigelson and Tina Kelly from April 29th, 2015. And the authors there speak to a University of Minnesota psychologist named Eric Klinger, who's done a lot of important research on mind wandering, fantasy, and daydreaming. And Klinger says that, quote, daydreaming accounts for about half of the average person's thoughts, amounting to about 2,000 segments a day.
Oh, wow. That's quite a lot.
Does that match with your number? I mean, try to think about it. How many times a day do you find yourself daydreaming?
I mean, the really critical way of putting this is that we are off task like half the time, right?
Yeah. Do you ever find yourself daydreaming while you're sitting right here in the podcast studio and I'm talking?
It's generally less daydream. I feel like if my mind drifts during podcasting, it's more like worry-based, you know?
Oh.
Like, I mean, I guess
That's daydreaming, yeah. It's a form,
well,
I guess.
It's the bad kind, though.
Yeah.
So, but I'm not going to think about space battles because ultimately our show is the space battle, Joe. Like the show is an escape, so.
Robert, you're going to make me cry. Warming my heart over here.
But the podcast booth is not airtight. The worries and the fears still manage to creep in.
Well, obviously, there's no way to totally keep them out. And that's one thing. I mean, one difference that I'm already seeing here is the difference between the idea of fleeting mind wandering and moments of daydreaming. I mean, if a person is having about 2,000 segments of daydreaming a day, those can't last very long just by the math of time.
Right. I mean, it's kind of like the money in the garbage can, like daydreams that are – they're regular, but they're just so fleeting that you don't – it's almost like they're not even occurring. They're really just like background static.
But when we think back to the story of M or to some of the people that we're going to talk about in a minute, it's clear that they're not just having like a moment of a fleeting daydream that comes for a second and then goes and then comes back a few minutes later and goes again. They are having prolonged, involved, continuous fantasies that spin out stories that have some sense of continuity and that they engage in a sustained way. So I think that's a kind of important and interesting difference, and maybe we can think more about that as we go on. But, I mean, one of the things we should take away from this is that everybody daydreams. Normal people do it quite a bit. There's nothing pathological at all about daydreaming. So there's really nothing abnormal about some amount of it, provided that it is really daydreaming and not some form of hallucination or something like that. I mean, normal daydreaming is a fantasy that the subject can clearly distinguish from reality. If you can't tell the difference between your fantasy and reality, then something else is going on and you definitely have grounds for seeking a mental health professional's help.
Right. The situation with M is not that she thinks the daydream is reality.
Yeah.
She just prefers it to reality.
But if it is really just daydreaming, clearly delineated from reality, it's also important that it doesn't occur in a way that's injurious to your way of life or to the lives of others around you. And we'll come back to that in a bit. So one of the things that's interesting about the recent attention on maladaptive daydreaming
is just the fact that we went so long with so little psychological recognition of the possibility that excessive daydreaming could be a disorder that caused suffering in people's lives. Probably the first major work on maladaptive daydreaming was in the Journal of Contemporary Psychotherapy in 2002, mentioned earlier by Ellie Summer, called Maladaptive Daydreaming, A Qualitative Inquiry. And Summer writes first about Freud's thoughts, which we talked about earlier, that daydreaming is this attempted solution to a deprivation state, that, you know, it's a form of wish fulfillment that's moderated by all these constraints that society puts on you. But then, of course, the idea developed. You've got Hartman in 58 saying that maybe fantasies serve some kind of actual adaptive function in the organism. You've got Eric Klinger, who we mentioned a minute ago, talking about how often people spend fantasizing or how much time a day people spend fantasizing. Klinger said he found in his research that most fantasies, including both sleeping dreams and daydreams, primarily involve current concerns, you know, stuff that you're thinking about right now. So, like, you're probably more likely, you know, not dreaming about space adventures, but about what's in your email.
Yeah, or perhaps, say, your evening plans, daydreaming about that, or particular video game or film you're looking forward to, right?
Yeah, or interpersonal conflicts. That's a big one.
Oh, yes, yes.
How common is that dream of, I'm having an argument with Jeffrey finally, and here's what I would really tell him?
See, now this is an area where I feel like it's still daydreaming, but one might easily categorize it more as simply worrying and rehearsing for strife. You know?
That's a lot of what daydreaming is.
I mean,
like, imagining scenarios is a way of thinking about what you should do.
But people, when they talk about daydreaming, sort of that the very positive spin on it, you know, where they say, oh, that Dan, he's such a daydreamer. Nobody's thinking, oh, that Dan, he's just always trying to think up what he would say if he had the courage to, you know, confront his boss or something.
Right.
Know?
Yeah, that's the good Dan. The Dan we like is the one who's daydreaming about swashbuckling on Mars and you know, flying around the ridges of Phobos. Mm-hmm. The Dan you do not like is the one who's thinking, like, here's what I should have said to Jeffrey. I should have told him that. But I know that is a common thing. I know people all the time are thinking about either what they would say if they had the guts to, or what they should have said in that argument they had yesterday or earlier today.
And that, at least, it can be in the short term maladaptive for a lot of us, you know? I mean, you have, like, something pisses you off. The next day, it can be difficult to focus on the things you need to focus on, or to be present when you need to be present.
Yeah.
Because you're just running the same dialogue through your head.
Well, you know, I actually have a kind of counterintuitive view about the virtues of venting. People often talk about how they had a bad day at work and they need to vent, you mm-hmm. know, and there's, like, I need to just let off all this steam and talk about it. I notice that in myself and in other people, venting very frequently does not alleviate frustrations but makes them worse. Because you just get to talking about it, and then you keep talking about it, and it makes you more obsessed with the issue than you would have been otherwise.
Well, it makes me think of the scene in Poltergeist 2 where the dad coughs up the awful Giger creature and then it crawls off. Like, that's what I feel like sometimes venting feels like. It's like, oh, it's out of me. But now it's out of me and it's disgusting and horrifying. Way to go. It's under the bed.
Well, I think if you're going to vent, I think you should try to keep it short. You know, you should say what you got to say, but don't dwell on it. If you dwell on it, it's just worse for you.
So pinch off that Giger monster when you're venting. Yeah.
That's right. Let her go. But then, okay, so back to Summer. So Summer's chronicling the history of this idea before we get to maladaptive daydreaming itself. And in 1981 and 83, he points out how Wilson and Barber discovered there's this group of people that they class as what are called fantasy-prone personalities, who were avid daydreamers. And these people tended to, quote, live much of their time in a world of their own making, in a world of imagery, imagination, and fantasy. So these people sort of have the ability to, like, pick a theme and not just think about it a little bit, but watch a scenario unfold in their imagination almost with the same kind of continuous quality as a person would watch a movie. Mm. They estimated that this group of fantasy-prone people with sort of high fantasizing capabilities is about 4% of the general population, or up to 4%. Other studies on fantasy proneness found somewhat similar numbers, maybe between 4% and 6% of people, but also found some interesting correlations. Fantasy-prone adults had often been encouraged to fantasize by a significant adult in their lives when they were younger. And also, fantasy proneness is correlated with aversive childhood environments, with some studies finding that though it's about 4 to 6% maybe in the general population, it was at a rate of maybe 9 to 14% in people with a history of childhood abuse. And this sort of goes along, you know, in a limited way with the Freudian idea, right? That if you had some kind of aversive environment when you were a child, you had some kind of thing that you wanted to get through, you didn't want to be present in the unpleasant reality you were living, you would learn to come up with fantasy environments to cope. And they also found that fantasizers were more prone to depression and other issues. And we should be clear that fantasy proneness is not necessarily the same thing as maladaptive daydreaming, because there could be people who are prone to fantasies, but it doesn't necessarily interfere with their lives.
And of course, when we're talking about adversity and trauma, I mean, it's not necessarily just like a situation of like physical abuse, right? But just say, problems at school, or we always have to remember how difficult, say, a move can be if a family picks up and moves from one city to the other, you know, changing schools, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. Or social problems, social isolation, any kind of family problems. I mean, things like that can drive a child inward and send them to their inner resources. I mean, I know, as you've probably described, I mean, you've had experiences like this, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, you know, moving from one school to another being an example, or being in a school where basically all of middle school, I think most of us can. Middle school was definitely a time that drove me inward in a way that I probably never quite returned from.
Middle schoolers really are the worst.
They are.
That is like the worst age of humanity.
Yeah.
Now, another strain of research that emerged in the 20th century was that while healthy people use daydreaming to kind of work through problems or to enhance good feelings, distressed people can often enter into a kind of negative feedback loop with daydreams in a lot of the same ways that you could see other addictions coming into play in people's lives, where the excessive daydreaming causes them to feel weak or inadequate or generally bad about their lives for various reasons. They might be, you know, missing out on things, that it's causing them problems. And then the problems in their lives are driving them to want to daydream more so they can escape from their lives.
It reminds me of the line in the Warren Zevon song, Splendid Isolation, where he's saying, Mickey, take my hand and lead me through the world of self.
Whoa. What album is that on? Was that the 80s?
Ooh, I'm not sure. When I got into Zevon, I was the greatest hits album.
I did.
So I'm not exactly sure where one finds that in its original form.
You're one of those Zevon posers. One of those Zozers.
Sadly.
So clearly there are different kinds of daydreaming, right? There are people with different levels of proneness. For some people it helps, for some people it hurts. And so Summer was trying to get a flavor of what this was like when people claim to experience maladaptive daydreaming symptoms. And so he used a qualitative methodology to assess people who presented with what seemed to be negative patterns of daydreaming, which again, he coined this term, maladaptive daydreaming. And so here's what he found. Common themes of daydreaming tended to be violence, idealized self, power and control, captivity, rescue and escape, and sexual arousal. And I think that's kind of interesting because it's strange how much it sounds like a list of the most common themes in adventure stories.
Yeah, I mean, basically that list could be the narrative flow of a swashbuckling tale.
Uh-huh. And then common functions he identified apparently were disengagement from stress and pain by mood enhancement and wish fulfillment fantasies. And then the other main one was for companionship, intimacy, and soothing. So there are all kinds of examples that he cites in his paper from the interviews. I just picked a couple of the more vivid ones to mention. Not all of them are this action movie-like, but I want to read one of the quotes. Quote, I used to imagine America and the West at war against the communist bloc. There were bombardments, shelling, marine landings, and hand-to-hand battles in which the communists would have many casualties. I imagine that my hometown is in ruins and under occupation, and I am fighting a guerrilla war with the underground. Sometimes I imagine myself fighting the guerrillas as part of the occupying forces. I often imagine myself as a soldier in battle against terrorists. I kill scores of them. The shooting fantasies relieve my tension. Sounds like Red Dawn.
Yeah, basically. And it also reminds me of the zombie apocalypse fantasies we discussed earlier.
Right, which can clearly serve as a form of mental empowerment and escape.
Right. And then also, like both of these examples, a simpler worldview in which
right.
there are clearly defined lines of good and bad, of enemy and ally. Here's another one. Quote, I am seated on the field of a football stadium surrounded with barbed wire. I am chosen by the prisoners to negotiate with the captors because she is known to be an emotionally disassociated person, hence not susceptible to psychological pressure. I am allowed to walk toward a desk with two chairs and sit in the bigger one. My opponent is putting forth his demands and threatens me with a gun. I pour myself a hot drink and sip from it with stable hands, smile at him and tell him that I am suicidal so he cannot threaten me with anything because I've got nothing to lose. He realizes he lost the bargaining and I give the sign for the insurrection to begin. From now on, it's like a Hollywood action movie with explosions, smoke, and lots of blood. Although I am wounded, I manage to free most of the prisoners and I lead them to safety. I love this because I get a real Garth Marenghi's Dark Place vibe from it.
Blood, blood.
And bits of steak. Yeah. It's such a great, great show.
Now, one of the really interesting things that I've found when reading about maladaptive daydreaming that's reported in this study, but then also in some others, is that there are some common processes associated with obsessive or maladaptive daydreaming, processes having to do with physical place and physical action, often with an object in the hand. Robert, you mentioned earlier when you were a child that you would daydream with a rubber band
yes.
in your hand, manipulating it with your hand.
Always. I had to have a rubber band, and it had to be green or red. It couldn't be just the brown ones because they weren't they weren't exciting enough. And also, this is, I guess maybe this sounds kind of strange, but the red and green rubber bands were explosions, and I would also make explosion noises as explosions were needed in these imagined scenarios because apparently there were a lot of explosions.
Well, I mean, given our samples, sometimes explosions have got to happen.
Yeah.
I want to read a quote from one of the subjects in Summer's study. Quote, when I daydream, I often hold an object in my hand, say an eraser or a marble. I toss it in the air. This repetitive monotone movement helps me concentrate on the fantasy. Daydreaming is easier when I do this because I don't get distracted by other things in the room. At other times, I would go down to the basement and pace for hours while daydreaming.
Hmm.
Also, from the same patient, sometimes I would go into an orchard behind my house. Nobody comes there. I like the solitude because I could act the fantasies out loud. I can shout and scream there without shame. And these are commonly reported elements. Having a place to go to, being in physical motion while doing the daydreaming, like pacing or driving or something mm-hmm. like that, and having an object to manipulate in the hand. Why? That is so interesting to me. Why those things?
Yeah, it really makes me think back on my own imaginative behavior as a kid, for sure. All right, well, let's take a break. And when we come back, we will continue and conclude our exploration of maladaptive daydreaming.
Mother's Day is right around the corner. And in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But We Loved is a new podcast about queer history coming May 15th. I'm Jordan Gonsalves, your host. Growing up, I thought being gay was the worst thing I could ever be. The gay history I learned was tragic.
Jerry had died of AIDS. And it's like, what is happening?
It was survival. That's why it's called survival sex.
But as I interviewed queer elders, I realized there was another history that I had never been taught. A history of courage and perseverance.
I wanted to take control of my story and not be ashamed of it.
And it was a history full of love.
The joy we found in saying husband again and again and again was incredible.
And while learning this new queer history from my elders, I realized they had so much wisdom to pass down.
The key is to understanding yourself. Learning to love and embrace yourself.
From iHeart Podcasts, I'm Jordan Gonsalves, and this is But We Loved. Listen to But We Loved May 15th on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. Now, we mentioned earlier there's a good piece in The Atlantic about maladaptive daydreaming from 2015 by Jane Bigelson and Tina Kelly called When Daydreaming Replaces Real Life that has some really good stories in it about what this experience is like. So I just wanted to read maybe a couple quotes from this article of the author describing her own experience. She writes, "When I was 8 years old, I had a game I liked to play in my front yard in suburban New Jersey. My siblings were older and mostly out of the house. My parents worked long hours, and when there was nothing much to do, I'd walk in circles while shaking a piece of string, daydreaming about Little House on the Prairie or the Brady Bunch. One afternoon, I created an episode where instead of going to Hawaii, where dangerous spiders lurk, the Bradys went to the Bahamas, where I'd just spent a week with my family. Greg Brady met my teenage sister there, and they started dating. The show playing in my head was so detailed and entertaining that it lasted 45 minutes. Another day, I imagined myself as the actress who played the seventh Brady sibling. I met all the other young actors on set, and they commented on my cute outfit and amazing acting skills." Again, the string in her hand, the object to manipulate.
Yeah, I totally get it. It's difficult for me to put into words, but I know exactly what she's doing there.
And the author goes on to chronicle how, with her experiences of obsessive daydreaming going on throughout her life, she eventually came to investigate this issue. Like, she got involved in the subject of maladaptive daydreaming at the research level, and she was a test subject in some research. And one of the things she found was that – so she went in for some brain imaging, for some fMRI – to look at what's going on in her brain while she's actively daydreaming. And one of the things they found was, quote, great activity in the ventral striatum, the part of the brain that lights up when an alcoholic is shown images of a martini. It's literally setting off some kind of addiction response type feeling.
Cheaper and healthier though, right?
Probably healthier, but not necessarily better for your life. I mean, depending on what the circumstances are. I mean, again, we certainly don't want to demonize healthy forms of daydreaming, but for many of these people, they end up seeking communities online for people who have the same issues as them or seeking clinical help because these people realize, like, this is taking up so much of my life, it is making me unable to live my life. It's interfering with my work, with my relationships. It's gone beyond its useful role. One of the other things that's interesting that gets pointed out in this article is the possible overlap between maladaptive daydreaming and a disorder that's been known as stereotypic movement disorder, which involves repetitive motions of the body, kind of like what we've been talking about with like pacing or repeatedly moving a, you know, an object in the hand. Like often SMD seems to have something to do with flapping of the hands or movement of the arms or something like that. And one of the things the authors talk about is that there was a study that studied children who have stereotypic movement disorder, 42 children, and this was in 2010. And when the researchers in the study asked the kids what they were doing when they were performing their repetitive motions, 83% of the kids said they were repeating stories in their heads. So it sounds like there may be some overlap with this existing known condition. And again, I wonder what is the neural link between the motions of the body and the internal storytelling impulse?
Well, it makes me think back to the more recent study we talked about discussing default mode network and the and being on autopilot. Like maybe there has to be some sort of autopilot thing you're doing. And it could be swimming or pacing about, but also just manipulating an object. Maybe you're not actually performing a task, but in object manipulation or some sort of basic tool use, maybe it's a necessary part of that network.
Yeah, that could be. You know, one of the researchers in this article who gets quoted talks about how there's a possibility that daydreaming is somehow kind of like a fever, like it is a natural defense mechanism. It's a cognitive defense mechanism for dealing with cognitive threats. But it can, of course, like a fever, be harmful if it gets out of control. And for some people, this defense mechanism, while in some cases useful, it does get out of control for them.
Well, that makes sense too. And when you think about the ways that that writers end up exploring, or not just writers, but any kind of creative individual is doing some sort of art or something they consider their art, you end up processing a lot of your own anxieties and fears and hopes and dreams through that art.
Yeah.
So it maybe is, and maybe that is just an something that's overlaid here and not part of the actual origin of the impulse. But maybe there's a connection.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I often think with like works of fiction, it's funny when people ask authors like to interpret their own work in light of their biography. Mm-hmm. You hear that. It's like, oh, you wrote this character in this novel who does this. What is that? How does that relate to your life? This thing that happened to you? I feel like you've got it backwards. You should be telling the writer how what they wrote explains their life. The writer doesn't know.
Yeah. Like often the writer has to sort of have the realization like, oh, well, I guess this story was about, my substance abuse problem or what have you,
Mm-hmm. And speaking of substance abuse, of course, I mean, one of the things that comes up again and again in these reports is that some of the people who experience maladaptive daydreaming compare it in some ways to an addiction. Going back to, what some of the brain imaging seemed to show we mentioned a minute ago was that there is an addiction-like response in the brain, and then some people subjectively describe it as being like an addiction. One of the people quoted in the Atlantic article says, "I felt the daydreaming was my main reality, and I'd only peek out into the main world now and then. It's like I'm an alcoholic with an unlimited supply of booze. I can't turn it off."
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, you don't have to worry about becoming physically ill from too much daydreaming. Or falling over from too much daydreaming, et cetera. Like it seems like there are fewer, obviously there are limits, but there are fewer hard limits involved there.
Yeah, that's true. But as we've seen, of course, it can be a strong interference with the kind of life people want to live. And that's the reason there are all these, you know, support groups and a push to get this more recognized in psychiatric and psychological treatment communities now. And there are some treatments that seem to be coming along. I mean, we're still in the early days of understanding maladaptive daydreaming as a psychological condition that is treated in a clinical way. But Summer, in his 2002 article, found that therapy helped some patients with aspects of their maladaptive daydreaming, including reducing violent themes in the daydreaming and reducing the amount of time spent on it. There are some drugs that in some cases have been found to work. Fluvoxamine, which is primarily used to treat obsessive compulsive disorder, has apparently been used with some success. Other patients have had some success with SSRIs. One of the most interesting things I came across was also from that Atlantic article that it referred to one person with maladaptive daydreaming who said, quote, "I recently found that constantly writing wandering thoughts down or keeping track of them keeps you from falling into intense daydreaming." So like the act of – I mean, this brings it back to the Freud issue with like creative writing versus daydreaming. Mm-hmm. The act of writing down your creative thoughts somehow makes them stop flowing so hard. And I mean, I know that from experience sometimes. It's almost like weaponizing writer's block against your own imagination.
You run the risk though then of you write down the ones that you think have promise and that – that fill you with joy on some level, but then maybe you don't write down the ones that are like stupid and awful, you know, the ones that fall into that special category of, you know, I feel like especially people who write up like horror or anything horror-esque, you know, they're liable to turn their fears into something useful, into something artistic, an artistic expression of their fears. But what do you do when it's just something dumb? Like it's dumb and it's hurtful. A dumb and hurtful daydream that you've got to make a special activity, I guess, of extracting it, of putting it on paper and then just wadding it up and forgetting about it.
Well, you know, I wonder – so there's the common experience of people sort of daydreaming by writing their lives into the existing plots and storylines of other TV shows and books and stuff like that. I wonder how often this type of daydreaming phases into just writing fan fiction.
Oh yeah, because you're I can see that where that could occur because you're just so into this world, you know, and then you can't help but want to become a part of it.
Yeah. I can't help but wonder in general if some people who have this condition would find relief through just creative writing. Like if you force yourself to write, kind of like this last person was saying, if you force yourself to write your creative thoughts down, that might only – not just limit them but also give you something productive you can do with that time you spent. So you don't just say, well, I spent 3 hours daydreaming today. I don't know, you know, where that time went. You could say, I spent 3 hours writing today.
Well, not only do I think that's a great idea, but I totally support anything that will create employment opportunities for my fellow creative writing majors.
Well, I think we have to accept that not all writing can be writing for money, and that's okay. But, you know, if somebody is trying to tell you to write, they should be paying you money.
So let's bring it all back to good old Kirk Allen.
Okay.
I mean, ultimately, we just don't have a lot of hard facts about who he was or what he actually went through. But I wonder how we can apply everything we've discussed in these two episodes to his case.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if he would have directly fit this emerging diagnosis of the maladaptive daydreamer. And I don't know. I wonder what we will continue to learn about maladaptive daydreaming in the coming years and whether that'll shed any new light on the Kirk Allen story.
Yeah. And of course, we have a lot of listeners out there who like to write in and share their experiences with us. And I know that all of you have experiences with daydreaming. And I imagine there are going to be some of you who have experience with maladaptive daydreaming or something that in self-analysis feels close to what we've described here. So we would love to hear from you. And of course, we can keep things anonymous if you want to do it that way.
Sure.
You know, so certainly just you know, stress that point when you reach out to us. But yeah, we want to hear from everyone about your daydreams.
If you have had maladaptive daydreaming, what have you found, if anything, that has helped you reduce that down to a tolerable level or helped you get along with your normal life?
Yeah, let us know. And if you want to let us know, the first step in reaching out to us is heading over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is where you will find all the podcast episodes going way back to the very beginning, including those alien abduction episodes, those X-File episodes. They're all on there. You'll also find links out to our social media accounts. You'll find a tab at the top of the page for our store where you can get some sweet swag that has our new updated logo on it, or podcast episode specific designs. A little bicameral mind here, a little black hole cinema right here. Anything you could want. Get on a sticker, shirt, and the proceeds, of course, support the show. And if you want to support the show in a cheaper fashion, just simply rate and review it wherever you have the ability to do so. That helps us a lot.
Big thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly to let us know feedback about this episode or any other, or just to say hi, let us know where you listen from, suggest a topic for a future episode, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.